My first Zen teacher gave a teaching once that the Buddha's contribution to humanity is the importance of sitting, you know, meditating, being present, waking up. And Gandhi's contribution to humanity is it makes a difference where you sit. So, you know, it's one thing to sit in the comfort of your own home or the comfort of your own community, if that's the case. It's another thing to sit in a place where the injustice of society is quite evident. We have to face it and deal with it and work with it. So I don't know if it's myth or how much reality is to it, but it's been said that Suzuki Roshi, when Zen master came to San Francisco, when they saw the building on 300 Page Street, thinking about buying it, part of the reason of buying it, right there, what was then kind of the inner city of San Francisco, around the housing projects there, was that it was felt it was very important to have Buddhism, where you sit is important. It was very important to have Buddhism somehow right in the middle of places where there's tremendous suffering in our society, as opposed to some place that's, you know, comfortably far away in the suburbs, and where you can kind of easily avoid some of the great tensions that exist in our society. So where you sit is important. So I remember some 15 years ago or so, there were people who did their meditation on the train tracks going in and out of Livermore the labs over there, because they were protesting the research that was being done there for atomic bombs. So, you know, they were just sitting meditating, right? Just like we were today. But they were sitting in a very strategic place, and so, you know, other people noticed. So, so this question, you know, this issue of where we sit, I think, is a shorthand for how do we relate to the various issues of suffering, of pain, of tensions and justice that exists in our society, both in our own neighborhood and our wider community and in our society. Do we live oblivious of it, or do we live somehow mindful of it? Do we live pretending it's not us, it's over there, or do we take it in, this is us, this includes us, and we should somehow take it in? For a long time, it stopped now for the last couple of months, but, you know, for a long time on Thursday and Friday mornings here at IMC, there was this very graphic anti-abortion protest right here in our street corner, literally in our street corner, and because there's Planned Parenthood across the street. And so it's a big fault line of American culture to have this the abortion, anti-abortion kind of debate or kind of pain. And so it was happening right here. And not in many ways I didn't want it there. But in one way I did want it there, and that was that it was good to be reminded. You know, rather than, oh, it's way over there. You know, it's way over there, wherever there is the problem. It's happening to us. It's here. It's so close. It's not something we can ignore. And when the Buddha was in his ancient times in India, he didn't just sit in one place. He often wandered around the country. And he instructed the first group of mature practitioners, the first group of enlightened people that he had as students. And when he had enough of them, he said, "Now go forth. No two of you follow the same road. And go out for the benefit of others." That was the instructions, to go forth and travel. And as a traveling group, the Buddha and his monastics, his teachers and his lineage, you know, they moved into all kinds of different communities, in and out of different communities. And you see in the discourses that survive of the Buddha how freely he seemed to have moved between different classes and castes and circumstances of his time in ancient India. He seems to have freely has spent time talking to the poorest of the poor, the so-called outcast class, as he did talking to kings and queens, talking to people who were sick, you know, any circumstance in life. Because he was traveling and wandering around, he came across all kinds of people. And so that was one way, you know, moving around. Here at IMC, you know, we're not going to pick up the building and put it on wheels and carry it around, so we can move into different communities. However, you know, we did do one move, our community. We used to be in Palo Alto. And then we moved to Redwood City to buy this building here. And one of the benefits of that move, is I feel, is that Redwood City is a demographically much more diverse community than what I saw in Palo Alto. And I was just delighted to be in a more diverse environment. And I was also felt that perhaps, hopefully, the kind of environment this year is more comfortable for a wider range of people to come into. Sometimes Palo Alto is actually uncomfortable for some people to come into. It's not their community. It's kind of frightening for some people to come in to that kind of community is relatively homogenous compared to other places. I've known people who lived across the freeway from Palo Alto, in East Palo Alto, who felt very uncomfortable coming into Palo Alto. But these often was mutual, right? The freeway divided. And so this is where we end up here. And so some of you, I'm happy with that, the greater diversity that's here. And, we don't travel now that we're here exactly, except through this internet. And hopefully we're set up in such a way that it's hard to know, but relatively easy to come here. We don't charge for anything. So not charging is one way to lower the barriers. It's easy to come. We used to have 7 doors here in the building to the outside world. We took one away. But I like the 7 because it's kind of maybe symbolic of something. I don't know what. Better than 6. The idea that we have had seven doors, to the outdoor world, meant it was really easy to come and go, symbolically. People can come, they can go. It's kind of nothing's asked. Certainly no money. Very little is asked of people. We have no membership here, and part of the advantage of not having membership is that we don't have a bounded community that then creates a bounded community identity. This is the real IMC, me, I'm the part of that. I'm an IMC person, and you have big, that who we actually are is quite fluid. And, no sharp boundaries between inside and outside. I like to say to anybody who wants to be a member is a member. Or if you don't want to be a member, that's fine. There's no need to because we don't have membership. So there are people who feel part of our community very far away, like these volunteers who are far away. All over the world now, people feel connected to us. People come here and they tell me that. They've been listening to the talks and following what goes on in our community from the talks and the announcements and stuff, and the questions and answers. Maybe closer, watching things closer than some of you are, because maybe some of you take it for granted. Sometimes when it's so close, people take it for granted. So the sense of who we are as a community is quite expansive and opening, and hopefully somewhat inclusive. And I think it's in the spirit of Buddhism, or the Buddha's teaching at least, to be inclusive and not to have boundaries about who is in and who is out, but to make the teachings and the opportunities and the whole thing available to anybody who would like to receive them. It certainly hasn't always been the case in Buddhism. Buddhism certainly has its history of institutional and cultural and various forms of prejudice and discrimination, some of it quite painful in its own way. And the comments by the Dalai Lama perhaps represent some of that. I think it's important for people to realize that the Dalai Lama is really the head of one particular order of Tibetan Buddhism. He's not the head of Tibetan Buddhism, even though he's the head of Tibetan state. And there's lots of Tibetan Buddhist teachers who happily don't listen to what the Dalai Lama has to say. He doesn't have any authority over them. And so what he has to say, people here in the West often look to the Dalai Lama as kind of like the Buddhist Pope. And so what the Dalai Lama says about Buddhism, this is what Buddhism teaches. It's one particular thread of Buddhism. And here at IMC, we're a different thread. And so there's these different threads. So it's helpful to just differentiate between different threads and strands. So we don't take you know, what one person says as being what Buddhism says. And so, and, you know, and I go, you know, when I go back and read the teachings of the Buddha, I find it a teachings, a way of life that's meant to be quite inclusive. And that's represented, one way it's represented is not only that the Buddha was so freely teaching anybody, but also in creating the monastic orders, order of monastic males and females, it broke down the caste differences that existed in India at that time as it does today. So once you enter into the Buddhist order, the caste differences have no meaning. And so, you know, whereas in the old times it was, you know, it was very important which caste you're in. And there's a great story of some royalty, a group of kind of royal men, royalty men, ex-princes or something, who decided to become Buddhist monks. But they had an attendant, a servant, who was kind of a lower caste person. And they all decided to become monks at the same time. And but they the royal princes, whatever, asked for the servant to be ordained just before them. You know, like, you know, a few minutes before them or something. Because once you're in the monastic order, caste has no meaning. However, seniority does. So they wanted to be sure that the person who was, you know, had been lower than before would now be, you know, higher than them, in order to kind of somehow break the old habits, the old customs, which are sometimes hard to break, right? And it was very painful when I was in a Japanese monastery to see how the seniority system in Buddhism somehow is misused. And I was the person who discriminated against me the most in the monastery there was the person who entered the monastery a few days before me, just before me, the person before me. And he was just awful to me. And so the Buddhist, you know, the ancient monks, you know, Buddha disciples wandered around India. And there's a story of Ananda, the Buddha's disciple Ananda, coming to a village and being thirsty. And going up to a woman at a well and asking for some water. And the woman at the well said, no, you know, I'm an outcast, I'm the lower caste, the untouchables kind of. And you, by bearing, look like someone who belongs to an upper class, a Brahmin class or the Kshatriya class, the warrior class, caste. And it's not proper for you to drink from our well because you would be polluted by that. And there's a special well, there's another well on the other side of the village for the upper class. You should go over there. And Ananda said, water doesn't discriminate between people. What he said is, sister, just as water does not discriminate by whom it is drunk or used, so too should the heart not discriminate between people of different backgrounds, races, customs, and social stations. These are mere conventions of our own human creation. They are not the Dharma. Please let me have some water. So she provided him with the water. The story goes on, and she fell in love with him. And so she followed him and wanted to marry him. And so she came to where the Buddha was and said, hey, I'm looking for this guy Ananda, you know, planning to marry him. Then the Buddha asked her, what it was she loved so much about Ananda? And she replied, it was his peaceful radiance, his purity, and his impartiality that had really won her heart. Within a few words, the Buddha was able to help her realize that it was not so much Ananda as a person that she was attracted to. It was more the qualities of Dharma that he embodied, purity, radiance, and peacefulness. And whereas the lives of people were fickle and fleeting, certain to be separated by distance or death at some point, taking Dharma as refuge was infinitely more rewarding and secure. Her eyes were opened yet again, And she there and then asked for going forth as a nun. It was not long after that that she realized awakening. So the idea of the Dharma doesn't discriminate between people by race or ethnicity or sexual orientation or, you know, size or health or whether you're introverted or extroverted. You know, it doesn't discriminate. The Dharma is here, available for everybody. And so this is an important principle. So how, as an institution, do we make that clear, make that available, make that the case? So the people, anybody who's interested, can feel comfortable coming here and receive what's here. It's been important for me that we demonstrated that this to some degree, maybe not enough, by having all kinds of different teachers come and teach the Dharma here. And there's a lot of women who come here. I don't know what it is now, but 10, 15 years ago, it was a more touchy issue around women in Buddhism. And we have a lot of women. When, you know, unfortunately, I can't do much about it but I'm stuck being a man for now. And so, you know, but I've tried to invite many women to come and speak. I've invited people who are gay to speak. I have invited people of various colors. I've invited people of, you know, different ethnicities, and people from different Buddhist backgrounds. Some, and partly because I think it's very rich that way, and very important to hear different voices and different expressions of the Dharma. But also, a little part of the agenda has been to try to make it clear that all that, all these different, no matter who human beings are, that they're all welcome to practice the Dharma for anybody at all. I think that it's kind of obviously, that comes naturally, I hope, out of sitting practice, meditation practice. When you sit and meditate, and the mind becomes somewhat still or calm or peaceful, the mind isn't going to hold on to conventions and concepts. I'm not going to cling to, you know, I'm this way and she or he is that way, or, you know, separation and hate and discrimination. And you can't hold on to it. It doesn't make sense. And so the emptying of the mind of concepts and ideas that happens in meditation provides a very important vantage point, reference point, then for opening the eyes afterwards and being willing to see the world, to see others in a fresh, new way. So, I mean, all of us have had the experience, I think, of being seen in a partial way. We're seen based on, maybe we've done something in the past. Once upon a time, far, long, long ago, you know, you, I don't know what, you did something. And that someone, that's all they remember of you, is that thing you did. So you're that kind of person. Or you're someone's spouse, and you're seen as a person's spouse. Or you're seen as a person of a particular ethnicity or a particular orientation or something, or all kinds of ways that you're seen. And it kind of feels kind of yucky to feel kind of limited in that way. So in sitting, we kind of hopefully with deep sitting or mature sitting, the eyes are clarified and the mind is emptied from being stuck in the old ways of seeing things. And we have the opportunity to see someone fresh, see someone new. And it's very much how I operate when I do interviews with people. That I, almost as a policy, I try to remember what happened before to some degree. But I also try to see someone who comes in for interview a second or third time, or whatever many times they come, as if I'm seeing them for the first time. As if what happened, what we talked about before, and, you know, doesn't exist, you know, doesn't. We have to be, you know, and some way like that, to see people fresh and new. And I think that comes out of the sitting. I think it comes to the emptying. But then the important question is, issue is, once the mind has been emptied to some degree, where do we sit with that empty mind? Where do we direct that empty mind? If we go back into life as it used to be, they might come back easily, those concepts and ideas, discrimination. Or it might be that we put on blinders. We choose not to direct it in certain directions, and so I'm not going to look at that kind of person. I find it very interesting with an emptied mind or relaxed body to notice how I react when I encounter different people, and walking around the streets or whatever, and how sometimes I'll tighten up when I'm around some people. Certain kinds of, something happens and I tighten up. And the vantage point of a relaxed body, the more relaxed you are in the mind and body, the more you notice a subtlety of the tensions that pick up, that happen. And I think that discrimination, it's very hard to discriminate against anyone if you're really relaxed. I think it's a sign of some kind of tension in the system. So I feel a tension, and then I pay attention to that. I stop and look at that. What's going on with me right now? What's going on here with me? And is this how I want to relate to this person passing on the street or sitting next to on the bus or whatever it might be? And I look for where can I come back to the place of being relaxed and open again? And if I felt uncomfortable with someone, I'll try to relax and open again. And then if it's appropriate, I'll try to actually, because if I was a little bit tense, I'll try to make contact. Because sometimes making contact for me is a way of really ensuring that the openness is there, the directness is there. Some years ago here in Sequoia Station, a shopping center nearby, there was a homeless man who asked me for some money. And I was going with my son to get a burrito. And I felt a little tension. It wasn't much, but I felt a little bit because, what else is this person going to want from me? How much will this person want from me? But the person said he was hungry. So I said, I won't give you a change. I'll buy you a burrito. I'll buy you some. Come with me. And so we went in together and I bought him whatever he wanted in there. And then he chose to eat outside, go back outside to eat. And I was kind of a little bit taken aback how modest his menu, his order was. I thought certainly he'd want more food, but he took what he wanted. And then when my son and I came out, he was there waiting for us. And he said, "I'm a poet, and I would like to read you one of my poems specifically for you, dedicated to you." And he took out this, he had this probably, shopping bag paper. And he had this, his corpus, all these different poems that he's written. And he read this beautiful poem. It really moved me, about compassion. And so it was just so great. So I could have given in to my little bit of tension and looked down and gone in and ignored him. That's one option. And instead, I turned towards him, and in doing that, received this beautiful poem in reply. Or the time, and I did the same thing in Palo Alto many years ago. Someone asked me for money for food, and I said, "Oh, I'll buy you. I'll buy you something. I'll buy you some. He wanted it at McDonald's right there. I'll go over and buy it for you." And he looked at me, and he said, "Okay, I trust you." I thought that was great. Put me in my place. any kind of way in which I was kind of being patronizing or whatever, I don't know. Just like, no. The Buddha was quite critical of the caste system of his time. And he had a variety of teachings critical of the Brahmins, who were the top of the caste system. Critical of, not them, but critical of the view, the philosophy, the understanding that allowed them to be there on the top. And kind of turning the tables on them a little bit, the Buddha said, Buddha was happy to use the word Brahmin, but the Buddha often didn't... He assimilated things rather than rejecting things. It's an interesting approach. So rather than rejecting the concept of Brahman, He maintained it, but he assimilated it into his own way. So he said, a real Brahmin is someone who lives with loving kindness, compassion, equanimity. That's a real Brahmin. A real Brahmin is someone who lives with a freedom in heart, someone who's open and present with freedom. A real Brahmin is someone who lives ethically. And so in so doing, he defined a Brahmin not by caste, not by skin color, not by birth, not by who you are in that kind of way, but rather by how you behaved, how you are in the world. So if you are in the world with compassion and love and friendship, if you are in the world with some kind of freedom from hate and greed, if you are in the world with you know, those kinds of qualities, those kinds of that kind of behavior, then you are a Brahmin. And one is not a Brahmin by birth. So in this way, the emphasis is not on, you know, what we are, in a sense. It's not a hard and fast difference, but what we are, but rather how we are, or what we do. Our actions are more important than who we were born as. So no matter how we were born as, it's not really our value or our the way that which we be seen should not be measured by how we were born so much as how we choose to act. And so the hope is that IMC as an institution can act with enough wisdom and friendship that we are a welcoming community. That no matter who someone is, if what they want to do is to practice the Dharma, to engage in the Dharma practice, that this is a place that is comfortable, and not only comfortable, but more, you know, maybe that's part of comfortable, but safe. And it's not always so obvious that a community feels unsafe to people. Just an introvert might feel uncomfortable here. You know, extreme introvert might feel uncomfortable sitting in a room full of people who are silent. You know, because all kinds of things can make someone feel unsafe. There was a story, I'm not sure if it was in the Inquiring Mind or the Spirit Rock newsletter, of an African-American man who went to sit retreat at Spirit Rock. And he grew up, in the 50s or 60s in the South, U.S. South. And in the course of the retreat, he started having kind of a panic attack. Really got really anxious. And he said the reason was that it was mostly, for him, his perspective, mostly white people he was with at Spirit Rock. And he was living in a place where he couldn't lock his door, because there's no locks on the doors at Spirit Rock. And it reminded him very strongly of almost being lynched by a mob of white people in the South during the 50s or 60s or whatever it was. So Spirit Rock seems like, you know, people have talked about how safe it can seem at Spirit Rock, one of the safest places. One woman wrote to Spirit Rock, said, this is the first time in my life where I felt safe to sleep with the doors unlocked and to walk around, you know, out in nature, up in the hills there, by myself. The first time in my life I felt that kind of safety. Because some people feel unsafe, you know, in the life they live. So for many people, Spirit Rock has been a very safe place. But even though it tries to be safe, you know, because of people's life experiences, even that kind of environment can feel not safe. So even IMC, you know, can feel not safe to some people or not comfortable for a variety of different reasons. And one of the important issues that as an institution I think we need to explore is how is it that we can make our community feel safer and more comfortable for the people who would like to be here, but for whatever reason at all, it maybe doesn't feel so comfortable and safe to come here. So maybe that's enough for me. So we have some minutes now. So now it's your turn. What would you like to say following what I've just talked about?
Hi, my name's Rick, and I guess one of the things I'd like to hear more about, because I know it's a big struggle in my life, is striking that balance between being very open. I understand that philosophy of empty mind and, you know, treating all people as equals, and yet at the other end of the extreme, needing to really discern things, situations, or people that might not be good for me, that I have to say I just have to be apart from that. And finding that balance is really tricky.
Yeah, I think that often enough, there's going to be some balance involved between it. And, you know, in certain situations, it'd be foolish to have an empty mind, undiscerning about what's going on around you, because it can be dangerous in some situations. And unless you have your eyes open and take it into account, you can get in harm's way. So I think that a few things. One is that I think it's very important to be aware of the choices you're making. Regardless of which choice you decide to do, to be conscious you're making the choice. Okay, I'm choosing not to talk to that person. So, and then why am I making that choice? As opposed to be unconscious about it or make it kind of subconsciously. And to really be conscious and take responsibility. This is the choice I'm making. Why am I making it? Is it out of wisdom or is it out of fear? And then look at it even more deeply. What, you know, is it, if you're afraid, or if you're disliking someone, or if you feel tense in some way, that's the place for you to practice. And sometimes the wise thing to do is to pull away from a situation so you have the ability to go in and look really what's going on. Sometimes you're better off learning about the situation by going towards the difficulty. So that's where you clarify it. Different people have different strategies, different ways, depending on what's going on. What you don't want to do is to decide, this is not the time and place to look at it, this is what's going on, so I'm going to go away and then ignore it, because then it's not an issue, it's out of sight, out of mind kind of thing. And that's not a healthy thing. So how to be discerning? I think being open and being discerning are two different things. And one of the ways to be discerning is to recognize what are the projections, what are the assumptions we have about someone else that we might be carrying. And so it's not just simply being discerning of the other person, but also what's going on inside of us. And this is where the empty mind, so what I'm calling today, the empty mind, is very important. Because a mind which is empty or calm enough can watch the production of an assumption, can watch the production of a judgment of someone else. And so even something as, you know, innocent as oh, that's a man, you can watch the creation of that thought in the mind, that's a man. And often that's a man doesn't come just with man, it comes with certain magnet for other associations what it means to be a man. So you can watch that happen. And if you can watch that happen, you can take more responsibility for it. If normally people who don't have a strong mindfulness of their own mind, the ideas, the concepts we're carrying in our minds, we're living through, are so thick and so pervasive, we don't even know they're happening. We don't even see the fish doesn't see the water it swims in. We don't see the concepts we swim in. And part of the advantage of meditation is we can start seeing some of the concepts we swim in. So I think a big part of the responsibility in all this, of course, is to look at oneself. And so we have the tools in mindfulness to do that, and both because of the mindfulness and also because of the degree to which we start having some inner well-being or peace or calm that gives us a better understanding of to watch how this stuff arises. So part of the discernment, so being open and empty doesn't mean we have to not be discerning. So in fact, probably keep your discernment going. But just being empty means you kind of have a beginner's mind. You're willing to look things fresh and new, and in that newness, you use your discernment. You have your discerning to what's going on. Does that make sense as a reply? Satisfying enough?
Yes.
Satisfying enough? Okay. Yes.
Well, you used the word fear,
And I always like to look at things with duality. It's just my nature. And the two ways I look at fear is a false evaluation of actual reality.
Say that again, please.
A false evaluation of actual reality. And then the other side is face everything, be real. And that balance that you spoke of, it's like if I have a feeling like that tells me that there's something amiss here, then I run with that feeling. And if there's something that can be gained, like you know, the benefit or the harm of it, either for towards me or the other individual, and then I act on that. And you know, sometimes fear can be like, okay, red light, stop, be aware. Or fear can be yellow light, you know, caution before you proceed. Or fear can be green light, go ahead, go forward. And in those kind of colors, I can see something like in a person who tells me that maybe it's better to avoid the person. And other times maybe it's better to kind of embrace the person. And a part of that is facing my fear, you know, face everything and be real. And the more I do that intuitively, the better off I am. I find out that I'm kind of conquering some fears that are preconceptions. And at the same time, I find sometimes that those fears are real and that, you know, I should listen. So it's kind of like a hit and miss thing. And the experience, understanding that, sometimes that can be wrong. And that's part of growing up. Is being able to take a responsibility towards what is the best thing for me to do. You know, even though it may not seem, sometimes it's the most compassionate thing to me and to the other person to just let it go and not even deal with it. And other times it's better to embrace it and deal with it. It just depends on where I'm sitting at the moment inside myself.
Mm-hmm. I agree, and to extend that a little further, what's right, what's appropriate for one person to do can be very different from someone else in the same situation. Part of the discernment is to understand oneself and one's own situation. So, you know, everyone brings different skills, different abilities, different things to the table. And so there isn't like one right or wrong way, you know, in this kind of discernment, this kind of issues. So, I mean, someone who's 6'6", you know, and has been a body, you know, weightlifter for a decade, you know, and looks kind of intimidating, might be able to turn towards challenging situations very differently than someone who's 4'4" and has health problems. You know, just somehow they can face the different choices have to be made. So I think being aware of one's own skills is very important. But having skills, developing one's skills, who we are is not fixed. And so we can develop skills, we can develop capacities, abilities that allow us to move into situations that in the past we weren't comfortable moving into. And so I think part of this thing about learning to be open to more people and different situations and not to succumb to fear or to hate is also a matter of developing skills and abilities. So developing skillful ways of communicating, for example. The story I like to tell of many years ago in Palo Alto, a woman came up to me and said, sometimes I park at night in Palo Alto by myself, and I feel that I'm afraid there. It feels dangerous to me. And I'm thinking of getting a gun. What do you think? So I didn't want to tell her what I thought. You know, everything I thought. I said, I don't want to be involved in recommending, whether someone does or does not get a gun. However, I think it's sad if the first line of defense is to get a gun. And without doing the work of the alternative ways, there are other forms of self-defense that a person can, it takes more work, right? A gun is pretty easy to get. But taking a self-defense class, it takes time and effort and money, a different kind of, you know, and maybe more money than a gun. And so, but you have to develop certain abilities to be able to fend off an attacker without guns. Some people have chosen that route. or to develop skills and communication skills that can diffuse problems. When I was a long-haired hippie, I was traveling through the U.S. South, and a number of times there was a tremendous amount of hostility towards me from white men, you know. And there was one situation that it looked like it was going to turn really violent, because, you know, it was a form of discrimination, right? And hostility was strong and palpable in the air, thick. And luckily for me, for us, one of the people I was traveling with was a amazingly talented natural comedian. And he was able to turn the situation around by through humor. And everyone was laughing. And then they let us go. So if you have a lot of humor, yeah, that ability, that helps. I think that, you know, it's interesting for people to reflect. I believe it's interesting to reflect that probably discrimination is something everyone has been recipient of, one form or the other, or another. It's a kind of a rampant thing in human society, seemingly. I've traveled a lot. Part of the advantage of traveling a lot, living in different cultures, is to see the way in which discrimination, racism, occur, and across the board, all kinds of ways. I experienced it, all over the world, all kinds of everybody, everybody has their kind of trauma, their difficulty. I was sexually abused when I was 6, so that's, what is that, sexual discrimination, sexual harassment? I was, when I was 10 or 11, I was living in Italy, and they have a religion hour in class. And so the first day of religion hour, the priest asked me to come to the front of the class, introduced myself, and he said, "What religion are you?" And I said, "I'm Lutheran." He said, "What religion are you?" Again, Lutheran. Go. I was dismissed, and he never talked to me again. So that was, And then a number of times in my life, being threatened with violence for who I was. In Italy as well, being seen as a foreigner. And only avoided getting my face not punched out by ducking. And then ducking under the guy's arms and running away. And, being hippies are kind of, maybe hippies is a matter of choice, but seemingly. But boy, I was not always comfortable being a hippie going around. You know, as I told you, in the South and other places. And living in Asia, or living in Hawaii. It's interesting for a white person to live in Hawaii because there's racism against whites in Hawaii. That it was very uncomfortable for me to experience. Like taking classes at the University of Hawaii and being the only Caucasian in the class. And when people are going to break into little groups, being shunned by everyone else because, I was, Or being in cultures where somehow, because being a white person, trying to talk to someone, and they would pretend I didn't exist. And they wouldn't respond. They wouldn't answer. And that happens this culture in America towards other people. White people have it kind of more relatively easy here in the mainland. Or in Asia, seeing discrimination in Asia between different Asians, different groups there. And so what I'm trying to say is that I think I operate on the assumption that everyone, if you scratch the surface of people, have been somehow or other the recipients of some kind of discrimination. And rather than seeing that as I choose to see that as a way to find what we have in common in a way that brings us together and arouses more sympathy and understanding and a willingness, enthusiasm for not perpetuating that kind of behavior. To find some way to free us from that. And my sincere hope is that something like Buddhist practice or mindfulness practice is an anti-discrimination tool, effort. That somehow in the practice itself will help it free us from the forces of discrimination that we might succumb to. But also, and also for some people, very importantly, it's a way of healing some of the trauma and pain that people carry from past discrimination, which many people carry with them. So I hope that IMC is a safe place for people. If it isn't, then my hope is that people let me know. That's my sincere hope, and I hope that then it's comfortable enough or safe enough to bring it up. And if you can't bring it up directly, bring it up anonymously or something. I hope, because that's really the great intention here, is to try to make it a place where anybody feels comfortable and safe who wants to practice.